Merit docket at this time with the case of Bond Hotel versus Watts. Mr. Shapiro, good afternoon. Nice to see you, Ms. Wyman. Anytime you're ready. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Good afternoon. This appeal may be a little unusual as a custody matter because the father, Helen, complains mainly of process rather than outcome. He complains in assignment of error one that the court allowed a non-parent, non-party discretion in prospective parenting decision-making by the language that was used in the final decree.
Well, it's really just entrusting someone's professional judgment, isn't it, when it's following any and all recommendations. Isn't inherent in that it's any of their professional recommendations or ones within their field of expertise?
To my way of thinking, the language was unlimited. It's without limitation. it's something beyond an admonition for the parties to cooperate with counseling. It's a requirement that they follow whatever recommendation the counselor makes without limitation, which I think intrudes into the right of parents to make parenting decisions. So, no, I wouldn't agree with that. Succinctly, if I could can read what my basic premise is. It is violative of a parent's fundamental due process right to parent his or her child and of the doctrine of parents patriae encapsulated in Virginia's statutory scheme for adjudicating custody disputes for a court to delegate prospective parenting decision-making to a non-parent, non-party, third party. It's agreed between the parties on brief that parents have a constitutional right to parent their children without unwarranted governmental intrusion. When courts become involved in these processes, they have to give deference and to the wishes and desires and parenting of parents. When a custody dispute between parents is brought before a Virginia court, of course, we have a statutory scheme for adjudication of those matters. Pretty simple. The court takes evidence with regards to certain factors bearing on the best interest of the child, and then the Virginia court can adjudicate custody by granting joint custody, taking joint custody away and granting it to one party as sole custody, or granting it to a third party non-parent. If the circumstances warrant. But nowhere within that, either the constitutional framework or Virginia statutory scheme, does it allow for a court to delegate prospective parenting decision-making, basically skipping over the parent, abdicating its adjudicatory authority, and delegating it to a non-parent, non-party, third party. And I think that's what's done by that language.
Well, counsel, wouldn't the words shall follow his or her recommendations be somewhat constrained by the other specific provisions in the order regarding custody and visitation? In other words, the court's order in all those regards would not be capable of being altered by that language, would it?
I just don't see it that way. I see that as a requirement. Let me give you an example.
So you see that provision as a requirement that the counselor says what to feed them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, then that's going to control.
Let me give you a simple but not unrealistic example. Let's say that the father has a rule in his household that little Isabella here eats all of her peas at dinner or she doesn't get ice cream. and the counselor determines that that's archaic, anachronistic, bad parenting, and directs that that rule cease. I think under that language, I mean, I'd be constrained to tell my client that he might be at risk if he took the ice cream away. I mean, I think that's what's implicit in that language. And that's why I fought to keep that language out, because the whole idea of cooperation and counseling was one thing, but to allow the counselor unbridled discretion going forward in making these decisions and requiring it of the parents, I think is a violation of constitutional law.
Can I ask you about the other issue, the in-camera interview? The statute says what it says, and our jurisprudence has construed it to mean that there needs to be a record made of any in-camera interview with the child. Now, what the court did here was basically summarize for the record what took place in chambers. Now, the statute doesn't say a verbatim recording must be made, so why isn't what the court did sufficient from the standpoint of making a record?
Well, because I don't think that's what's meant by the record requirement of the statute, nor do I think that suffices for purposes of why the codification was made, which was to assure procedural due process for a parent whose kid disappears behind closed doors with the judge and the guardian ad litem without their lawyers present. And the judge comes out at the end and says, you have a beautiful child, you're so lucky to have her, she's delightful, she loves both.
So is your argument that an in-camera interview is prohibited, you know, in other words, despite the statute permitting it, the parent's rights trump that? Is that your argument? That there's no right to an in-camera interview without the parents being present?
No. I think when an in-camera interview is conducted, there needs to be a record made. And the clear meaning of the statute, when it provides for the cost shall be assessed as part of the cost of the proceeding, can only mean that a record of some kind and a transcription, because it wouldn't make any sense otherwise. But beyond
that... Well, it
seems
to me the intent of the statute is to preserve whatever occurred in chambers. Courts like us, appellate courts like us, can consider, you know, whether or not anything the court did was error.
And, you know, there are other places in Title 20 where there's a requirement on the part of the court to establish in the record and in the court order the circumstances under which decisions were made, like deviations from child support guidelines, and there are other examples. This language is not used where that requirement was statutorily mandated. I think this is very, very specific, and that is, I think what happened is the legislature took its lead from decisions of this court and other courts with regards to what was required and a transcription be made.
So, except the statute doesn't use the word transcript.
Well, the statute doesn't specifically, but the statute says a record and establishes...
Counsel, let me interrupt you, please. Let me interrupt you. We use the term record in a very broad sense in this court. I mean, the record includes exhibits, it includes the arguments made by counsel, it includes the testimony of the witnesses, it includes the exhibits. You know, that's all part of the record, including all the things that are in the court's file by way of, you know, pleadings and charging documents and, you know, probation reports and you name it. If it's part of the case, it goes into the record. It's not necessarily the verbatim transcript. So to the extent that record is a term of art, you know, it seems to me it's not necessarily a verbatim transcript. So the question would be really, what did the, you know, if the court, you know, if we have a conversation at sidebar, and then the court puts into the record or counsel proffers for the record what occurred at sidebar, that makes it part of the record, doesn't it?
Yes, but in the context of a judge and a little girl, and in this case a guardian ad litem, going into the judge's chambers, I think all of what you just described as being generically part of a record wouldn't apply. I think it's clear that what was...
What authority do you have for that proposition?
Well, I have only the statutory language as authority.
Okay.
And the fact that it makes reference to the cost of same, which I think clearly indicates the cost of a transcript to memorialize what went on.
If there is any cost to it.
If there is any cost.
Because some of these cases are tried without a court reporter.
And it may very well not be transcribed at all. So yes.
So a record can be made without a court reporter?
Well, in this case, of course, there wasn't a court reporter who kind of interesting. I was a trial counsel and reading the transcript. The judge has got little Isabella on one hand, and he's going through the door, and the bailiff is tailing on behind saying, they want it recorded, they want it recorded, and the door shuts, and no court reporter.
But there's some of these cases that are tried, maybe the exception these days rather than the rule, but there's some of these custody cases that are tried without a court reporter even present in the courtroom. What about an in-camera review then? How does the record get made if not by the court?
I think the court has to, if the court is going to hold, the court doesn't have to hold an in-camera interview.
I understand that, but we're assuming for the purpose of the question that the court is.
If the court's going to hold an in-camera interview, then I think it's incumbent upon the court to satisfy the provisions of memorializing what went on back there in some appropriate way, other than simply coming out and telling everybody what a great, you know, a wonderful child they had, which is what you usually get when judges come out of these in-camera interviews.
Right, let's assume it's error for the sake of this question. How is it not harmless when the judge neither solicited nor received a preference from the child, but instead put on the record that the purpose of this interview is merely to reassure the child?
Well,
What evidence do you have that it affected the decision in any way, shape, or form?
Well, I mean, that's the whole purpose of procedural due process in allowing parents to know what went on back there. I can't answer that question, nor can my client.
So, in other words, you doubt the integrity of the court when they tell you what's going on or what went on?
Well, I might be a little more, you know, satisfied with memorializing what went on if it was in a little more detail than what usually goes on and what went on in this
case. I think Judge Attlee's question is, let's assume there's error. And let's assume it's constitutional error, due process violation. There still has to be evidence of harm. You know, even with a constitutional, you know, problem there, you know, you still do a harmless error analysis. Now, it's a higher bar to get over, but you still can get over it. And I think Judge Attlee's question is, isn't the harm here purely speculative because you're not taking at face value what the judge says occurred, but you don't know what extent he might have been wrong?
Isn't it always going to be speculative if you don't have a record?
I think that,
when
that answers answered my question, I think.
I mean, the whole purpose of having a record made of whatever description is that I could answer that question for you. My client would know. You know, in this case, there was a serious issue with regards to the guardian ad litem. It was raised, wasn't addressed. Guardian ad litem goes back there. My client felt like his child was intimidated by the guardian ad litem. She shouldn't have been back there. We don't know what happened back there. Judge said he wasn't going to let the guardian ad litem.
I wasn't intending to make you chew up all your rebuttal time in answering my question.
With regards to...
With regard to your third assignment, what case law or authority do you have in support of that assignment?
I have to rely on my brief for purposes of answering that question.
Well, there is none in your brief.
The purpose of the third assignment was basically an objection to the fact that this was sprung on counsel during trial. The rules were changed.
Well, let me help you try to walk through the answer to Judge Attlee's question. The trial court did not admit the statement, redacted the statement from the hospital record because it was hearsay. I understood on brief your assertion being essentially that it was admissible as an exception to the hearsay rule, Now, as hearsay within hearsay, it has to meet every aspect of it has to meet an exception. Now, let me finish my question,
sure.
Counsel. The hospital record, I presume, came in as a business record, which is an exception to the hearsay rule. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Correct.
So the only exception that would apply to the redacted statement, arguably, it seems to me, would be the state of mind exception. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, and that was raised, and I...
And the state of mind exception is relevant only, in other words, the individual state of mind at that time, which, as I understand it, was some 2 years prior to the hearing in this case. Is that correct?
It was 2 years prior to the de novo hearing.
So the court made a decision to exclude that statement, and it seems to me, on an abuse of discretion standard, the court may well have concluded that the state of mind of this child 2 years earlier was simply not relevant. Why is that an incorrect ruling under the rules of evidence?
I obviously inartfully, but attempted to rely on the fact that in the court's pretrial order, it made that document admissible.
Okay.
But your adversary is not the gatekeeper of the evidence, correct? Just because your adversary fails to object to something does not make anything you perhaps want to tender to the court admissible, correct?
Well, but the court order clearly made that document, that exhibit, admissible.
No, so the court order removed somebody who does not object their ability to object at trial or to otherwise contest that piece of evidence. It doesn't just simply say that anything not objected to is automatically admissible, does it?
What the trial court said in rejecting it was, I can't make not hearsay hearsay. Well,
that's a correct statement of the law, isn't it?
Well, that is, but that wasn't the point. The point is that in a pretrial order that became the law of the case, it made that document admissible. And if we as lawyers, trial lawyers, in trying to prepare for trial, can't rely on the court's pretrial orders as rules of law, then we certainly are handicapped in our ability to do so.
But those pretrial orders don't govern admissibility. It does not make something admissible or inadmissible before it's presented to the court. All it does is control what your adversary is or is not able to argue, correct?
Well, if the adversary isn't able to argue admissibility...
The court's still the gatekeeper. Doesn't have to take something that has nothing to do with this case and say, well, I guess I better consider it now because it hasn't been objected to.
Wouldn't the court then have to correct or amend or in some way vitiate the court order that, in my opinion, made it admissible?
Well, I think we're coming from different sides of this. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. Our position is that with regard to the three errors, is with regard to the issue of talking to the child in chambers, is that the court did make an adequate record under the circumstances and under the rules of the statute, that when the judge came out of the chambers, he said what occurred in chambers. He also indicated that the child gave no preferences and that he... wasn't using that with regard to a preference from the
counsel. Let me steer you to the first issue because that's the one that I think concerns me the most. What authority does a circuit court judge have to delegate his or her adjudicatory authority to a third party?
I don't think requiring the child to participate in counseling and having the parents cooperate with the counselor does take away their parental
authority. I certainly think that the court could have ordered participation in counseling, but the order was a lot broader than that. The order required basically the parents to comply with any recommendation the counselor made. Now, my concern is that if the parents object to whatever the counselor may say, there's no opportunity to have the court adjudicate. In other words, they're required to comply without any opportunity to object or to assert any parental authority or constitutional bar or anything else.
I think they do have the right to go back to the court, but I think what the court was saying is, and the difference between the two orders was
how would they go back to the court without a the law is clear. You can only go back if you have a material change in circumstances or in a contempt situation. So you got to be held in contempt first, in other words?
It would be a material change in circumstances if they felt that the counselor was recommending something that wasn't in the child's best interest. If they had that kind of disagreement with the counselor. But I think what the court is doing is allowing the professional to do his job or her job. And you know, there's not much point in going to counseling if you're not going to cooperate and follow the counselor's recommendation.
So what if the counselor's recommendation was that one spouse or the other should get additional visitation? If I understand your argument correctly, their compliance would be required without further action of the court, correct?
Not necessarily.
Well, that doesn't answer my question.
Court,
it seems to me that's
got to
be a binary.
No, but the court set out the visitation rather specifically.
No, but I'm saying, what if the counselor said, my recommendation, I don't care what the court said before, after evaluating my professional opinion, somebody should get additional visitation. Pick your party, I don't care.
Well,
the point is that they're, under this order, compliance is required.
I don't think that language gives the counselor the right to contradict the court's order. The court's order is the court's order.
Well, the point is, in the court's order, it seems to me implicit, that's one of the arguments, may arguably at least implicitly, the counselor can recommend something different. Because the court has incorporated future unheard, unreviewed recommendations by a professional, third-party professional, that the parents are going to be obligated to honor upon pain of contempt. That's what disturbs me about this order. So how do we get...
I hear what you're saying. I don't think the counselor has the authority to modify the terms of the court's order.
Why shouldn't the court simply be required to, if a counselor has a recommendation that he or she asserts is the child's best interest, to go back to the court and let the court review it and decide whether or not to implement it? Why should the court be permitted to delegate that to a third party?
Well, I don't see that the court was delegating that to a third party. I don't see that there's a difference between following the recommendations and cooperating with the counselor. I think those are two of the same things, and that's what the judge was trying to do, was to ensure that this child got counseling and got the help she needed.
Okay, let's assume I disagree with you. What can you point to in the way of precedent or case law or statutory authority to permit the court to do what it did?
I don't have it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We will come down to Greek Council and then move on to the next case.
Okay.